ITCFM is the award-winning community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice. BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Britain's coalition is not what we elected. It's a government by the millionaires, for the millionaires. In a national financial emergency which is hitting the sick, the young and the elderly worst, why is it the super-rich and multinational corporations pay virtually no tax? So we have tax havens in the crosshairs this week. Yes, tax havens, those places all the politicians want to close, but nobody ever seems to get round to doing anything about it. For example, it's emerged that the Tetra Pak billionaire Ava Rousing kept much of her wealth offshore via a cabin apartment she'd bought on a cruise ship called The World that just chugs around the world's oceans. Another tax dodge. There's seemingly infinite tax avoidance schemes for the super rich. But what about the rest of us? We're taxed income tax at source. John Christensen from the Tax Justice Campaign will be here. And Bristol had a distinguished visitor this week. Ronnie Casserils was one of the main organisers of the 1980s-focused anti-apartheid movement, which helped the African National Congress overthrow the white minority racist government of South Africa. On the eve of Bristol's EDL march, he has some film tips and advice on today's struggles. But first, Martin Summers' weekly roundup of world events. Martin, first of all, this amazing story we were going to do last week, we didn't have time. This is about the discovery of the radioactive element polonium on the effects and the clothes of the former leader of the Palestinians, Yasser Arafat.
Yeah, I mean, if people want to read a good article about this on the internet, they should look up Uri Avenery. U-R-I, Avenery, A-V-E-N-E-R-Y. And he's a Jewish guy, he's an Israeli, but he was a close friend of Arafat's. He was also, in fact, one of the founders of the State of Israel. He was actually part of the military resistance to British rule. But he's actually, you know, he's taken a much more moderate line in his later years.
Now, Arafat died around about 2004, I believe.
Yeah.
And it was just thought, well, he's got old and died. But now, is there anything to suggest that maybe, I mean, if polonium, this particular radioactive element, I mean, this was also used apparently in the murder of Litvinenko, wasn't
Indeed.
It? This is the Russian guy.
I mean, I'm not an expert on murders by using these techniques, but it does seem that polonium is one of the...
Well, you're forgiven for that, Martin. Do you know why? Because this has hardly ever happened before, and people are now discovering how it is that polonium actually kills people.
I think unless you've got a Geiger counter, polonium is difficult to detect, I understand.
But it's also the symptoms. Doctors are just simply not aware of what symptoms this might bring about in people.
Yeah.
And an article on Al Jazeera, who revealed this story, first of all, with the report from a Swiss laboratory that had examined Arafat's clothes. I mean, it's a rather nasty story, but as he was dying, he was coughing and choking a lot, was being very sick, so there was quite a lot of material from his stomach was actually on his clothes. And this there was where they found this polonium. And they say there's little scientific consensus about the symptoms of polonium poisoning, mostly because there's very few recorded cases, as we were saying. Litvinenko suffered severe diarrhea, weight loss and vomiting, all of which were symptoms Arafat exhibited in the days and weeks after he initially fell ill. So can you just give us a little bit of background on this other case, this Litvinenko? Who was he?
Litvinenko was a former FSB agent in Russia.
This is the Russian Secret Service.
The Russian Secret Service. It's the successor agency to the KGB. And if people read his book Blowing Up Russia, written with Yuri Feltsinsky, they will see that the Litvinenko's main allegation was that the bombs which were carried the bombs in September 1999 in Russia, which I call 999 because they all went off in September 1999, so we have 9/11, 7/7 and 999. They killed hundreds of basically ordinary people living in working class tower blocks. It was blamed on the Chechens, and the Russians invaded Chechnya on the back of that, which basically allowed Putin to win the election, which the communists looked set fair to win, because Putin came in as a sort of, you know, strong man who was going to deal with these Chechens who were killing our people.
So Litvinenko...
But it turned out in actual fact that... well, what Litvinenko alleged was that in actual fact the bombs were planted by the FSB, and I think there's a fairly strong consensus.
So why would they do that?
What was happening was that in November of 1999 there was a presidential election in Russia, and the opinion polls were giving a fairly strong lead to Gennady Zyuganov, who was the leader of the Russian Communist Party. And the reason why the communists were doing so well in the polls is because most people's living standards in Russia had crashed completely. A tiny minority of oligarchs had managed to seize all of state assets as personal property, and the communists were mobilising the discontent with that. And I think that would have been quite an interesting outcome if the communists had won a democratic election in Russia. We could then have had a dialogue about what sort of things we needed to do together with them to get a sort of more manageable capitalism, if you like. But that was all blown away by the bombs. Putin arrives on a white horse and says, "We're under attack, vote for me." And these kind of things do work. And so, people voted for him, and off we went.
So Litvinenko died in 2006 in London.
Yeah, for dressing this up.
I mean, after writing this book, Blowing Up Russia. Now, the obvious potential culprit for that is Putin and the United Russia Party, the people who benefited from that bombing.
It is true. But one of the other people who benefited from that bombing was Putin's then ally, Boris Berezovsky, who is based in London.
He's a sort of Russian version of Rupert Murdoch, isn't he?
Yeah, well, even...
He
yeah.
was, until he was...
Or a James Bond villain or something similar. But the point is that the oligarchy brought Putin in to keep the communists out. And Putin... I'm not directly accusing Putin, but the Soliviki, as they call them, the security apparat, and they basically fixed the election for the oligarchy to keep the communists out. So Zyuganov, in the last week of the campaign, stood on the podium and said, "This is now a straight fight between the Communist Party, represented by me, and the KGB, represented by Putin." But of course, he was speaking speaking to the winds, because the fear and the shock created by all these deaths and bombs, and hundreds of people had died, gave Putin the edge. And this is the kind of thing that happens, folks, not just in Russia but elsewhere. When people with a lot of power are under pressure, they turn to dirty, underhand methods to keep power. We shouldn't have to explain this to people. It's so obvious, it doesn't need explaining, but people are often quite naive about these things.
Okay, we're back to polonium and the connection between Litvinenko and Yasser Arafat. Animal studies have found similar symptoms which lingered for weeks, depending on the dosage, until the subject died. The primary radiation target is the gastrointestinal tract, said an American study conducted in 1991, activating the vomiting centre in the brainstem. So, you know, certainly the polonium, traces of polonium on Arafat's body, that looks as if it may be, you know, it may be poisoned with polonium, and now also the parallel symptoms with Litvinenko. What would it actually mean if he had been poisoned, and who would have done it?
Well, Yuri Avery, I mentioned him earlier. If you read his articles, it's quite simple. He said it's the Israeli cabinet made a decision to kill him, and I've always believed that that was what was going on. And he said, he was a personal friend of Arafat's, and he said, well, his personal security was hopeless. He used to be very, very open to having people meet him and come to sit next to him at meetings and things like this. And he said, you know, Israeli prime ministers are much better protected than that. He was a bit sloppy about the security. I think Arafat's position probably was, the Israelis won't want to kill me because I'm a useful bridge and I want to make peace with them. So why would they? But of course, he's presuming that they are genuine about wanting to make peace, and it doesn't look as if they were then or are now.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
There's also been a great little article in The Guardian about the Syrian National Council by our friend Charlie Skelton. And he's also got another series of 10 o'clock live as well, by the way. But who are the Syrian National Council, Martin?
Well, that's a mystery, isn't it? I mean, they claim to be representing the Syrian people, but there's clearly a lot of infighting going on. And we will see who they end up being if they end up in power.
So who are they now and who's organised them?
Well, it seems to me that the Syrian National Council has been cobbled together by the Western powers so that there is, in fact, somebody to negotiate with, some protege to put into power inside Syria. I mean, the situation in Syria becomes more opaque by the day. We've had these defections now by the ambassador to Iraq and by a leading Syrian general. I imagine that the Western powers are hoping that the Syrian state will crumble in a similar way to the state in Libya. But I think Syria is a much more complicated place than Libya. They've had a so-called free election in Libya, which seems to have gone reasonably well, and I wish the Libyan people well, whatever they've been through, whatever side they're on. But the Syrian situation is very complicated, and all the big powers, the Israelis, the Iranians, the Americans, the British, the Russians, they've all got their finger in it. And that's probably a big tragedy for the Syrian people, because it means that they are the focal point of a potential flashpoint for international conflict.
So how do you see it panning out in the next few weeks? I mean, we've had more announcements almost daily that the Syrians have potentially, the government has potentially done a massacre. But then we also hear, well, we can't confirm who has actually done this massacre.
I think what you've got to realise is that both sides are trying to use the media in order to mould the battlefield, and this is the way modern wars are fought. And basically, one has got to presume that everybody is lying in order to try and achieve their political goals. And therefore, when the government says they didn't do it, and when the Free Syrian Army says they didn't do it, they possibly both lying. And I suspect that, like most wars, everybody's in the wrong. I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia. There was more than two sides. There was at least three and possibly eight, and everybody was lying. And that's what wars are like.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Also, Keith Allen's Princess Diana film, All Unlawful Killing, has been canned. A documentary by a controversial filmmaker, Keith Allen, called Unlawful Killing, focusing on the death of Princess Diana, has been shelved under potential legal action it may face. Keith Allen's Unlawful Killing documentary will therefore not make it to our screens. The film, which sees Allen question the circumstances surrounding Diana's death, received an unofficial screening in Cannes last year. A spokesman for the company behind the film said that Unlawful Killing has been sold all around the world, but there is a specific form of insurance needed by the US distributors to cover them for their French and UK offices. This proved impossible to secure, so therefore the film has been permanently withdrawn.
Well, I mean, you can get it online, presumably, even now.
Well, actually, no, you can't. You can't buy a DVD of it, which is a great pity. I mean, we have actually, in previous programmes, had a few extracts from it. I mean, it certainly focuses on Prince Philip's connection with the Nazis, and it also looks at some of the particular circumstances around things like the embalming of Diana, also the fact that it looks as if the actual people who were pursuing the car that night were not paparazzi, that they had very high powered motorbikes, this kind of thing, and there's lots of evidence that comes out in there. But what kind of situation are we at now, where we are actually not able to see this documentary? It starts to make you think that that there isn't any kind of real freedom here if you can't actually show a documentary. Keith Allen's obviously, and Al Fayed, poured thousands, hundred thousands of pounds into this film, and yet no one's going to be able to see it.
Well, I mean, basically, we know that we live in a very, very flawed democratic state. And the question of how democratic it is a serious question that we have to ask ourselves. The banks and the military-industrial complex run things. Most of politics is simply window dressing.
So if anyone does want to watch it, you can watch it. It's on YouTube. There was a Press TV, that's the Iranian channel, funnily enough, that actually did a review program of it over several episodes. So you can just about watch the film sort of being shown on the Iranian television and reviewed by various people. So it is just about possible to watch. But, I mean, it'd be nice to know, and I will let you know, if the DVD is ever actually made available.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, pensioners are having their homes taken off them. Young people are being plunged into massive debt if they want an education. Disabled and the elderly are having their daycare centres closed. Around a quarter of families are lacking a decent state of living, we hear this week. And thousands of those are having to turn to food banks now to feed their children. It's not as if the money's not there. It's in the hands of the 1%, many who pay no tax at all. In a scandal that's only now unfolding, many BBC government employees are paid as a company as well. Where that company is based is in a tax haven. They pay no income tax. On BBC Question Time recently, the Lord Chancellor and Bilderberger, Kenneth Clark, blushed red as he explained tax havens must be closed. So did he really mean it? Well, it's an old story, but brought into sharp focus when the rest of us, even those with a job, can't make ends meet. John Christensen directs the International Secretariat of the Tax Justice Network, a research-led global coalition of experts and activists. He trained as an auditor and an economist and has worked in many countries around the world, including in secrecy jurisdictions, which I'm sure he'll tell us about, where he worked in offshore financial services with Touche Ross & Co. For 11 years, he was economic advisor to the government of the British Channel Island of Jersey. In the past 10 years, he's become what The Guardian has described as the unlikely figurehead of a worldwide campaign against tax avoidance. Well, hi, John, and welcome to Drive Time.
Well, hello, Tony.
First of all, can you just tell us whereabouts are the biggest tax havens?
Well, you know, many people think the tax havens are sitting in the Caribbean or little islands in the Channel or Gibraltar, places like this. You know, the really big tax havens are countries like United States, Switzerland, Luxembourg, Netherlands, and would you believe United Kingdom? These are the really big players in this game. Most of them are powerful countries who have political connections. In the case of the United Kingdom, for example, we're closely connected to the Channel Islands, to the Cayman Islands, to Bermuda. And all of these tiny little islands, which people think of when they think of tax havens, are part of the British spider web, as we call it, of tax havens that feed money into the City of London. So we're talking about very big and very powerful countries, which for many years, for decades in fact, have been protecting tax havens, supporting them, blocking global attempts to clamp down on them. And when we hear senior politicians talk in London about wanting to close down, I think we should take it with a very, very big pinch of salt, because they have no intention of doing anything about these places.
So are you saying that Kenneth Clark didn't really mean what he said then, when he says, oh, we really must do something about this, on Question Time the other week?
Well, I heard people talking in the 1970s about we must do something about tax havens. I heard the same in the 1980s, the 1990s. 3 years ago, the Prime Minister talked at the G20, and in the Senate in Washington, he stood up and said, the time has come to close down the tax havens. And do you know what? Time and time again, Britain takes the lead in blocking attempts to close down tax havens. So, no, I'm afraid I don't believe politicians when they say this.
Now, once upon a time, you weren't actually able to just ship large, vast amounts of money abroad. When did that all change? Is there any point that you can say, well, it was the whole sort of tax haven boom started at a certain time, you know, sort of in the 70s or something?
Well, that's right. You know, back in the from the 1940s onwards, after the war, a new settlement was put into place. It was called the Bretton Woods Settlement, with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund there. And what they did was they made it very hard indeed for people to export capital from one country to another, because they recognized quite rightly that capital moving around from one place to another can be very destabilizing and encourages tax evasion. So they put into place a whole apparatus around the world, but it didn't stop people, but it certainly brought the tax evasion down to a very low level. It all started going wrong, I think, in the early 1970s, when President Nixon, under huge pressure because of the Vietnam War, he was under pressure to protect the dollar, and he started to allow American banks and others to shift and start operating in London in a pretty unregulated market called the Eurobond market. And at that stage, the whole tax haven thing began to really pick up big time from the 1970s onwards. And it was a key part of Mrs. Thatcher's development strategy for this country to deregulate London in order to attract these huge illicit financial flows from other countries.
But that's one thing to say, you know, you want to attract money in, but I mean, surely that's not the same thing as saying, well, people should be able to ship all their money out of the country.
Well, the trouble is we've never been too fussy, you know, we've not too fussy about what money comes in, and we're not particularly fussy about how our own elites shift their affairs offshore into Luxembourg and Switzerland and so on. And if you want evidence for, you know, the way in which the British government talks the talk of tackling tax evasion but doesn't actually walk it, the truth of the matter is this year they've negotiated a new deal with Switzerland to protect British tax evaders using Switzerland. And we know the scale of money involved runs to many billions of pounds, but British government isn't prepared to take active steps to close it all down, mainly because the people who use offshore accounts in Switzerland are engaged in tax evading in Switzerland and places like Jersey are, let's be honest, very closely connected to the political elites and the business elites that shaped policy in London.
Now, I can remember a couple of years ago, a plucky banker, at least he was working in a bank, Rudolf Elmer, he actually got a whole bunch of tax evaders on a compact, on a CD drive, and copied it, and he took it to WikiLeaks. And if I remember rightly, he was actually arrested for his trouble. Now, the idea here was he was trying to expose the names of people and also the amounts that were being kept secretly in these Swiss bank accounts. So what do you know about his case?
Well, that's right. I was, in fact, with Rudy when he handed the CDs across to Julian Assange from WikiLeaks. You know, Rudy is, in many respects, he's a really heroic guy. He's just an ordinary bank manager. He was working for a Swiss bank, and he was sent to work in the Cayman Islands, which is a British tax haven in the Caribbean. And what he discovered when he turned up at that branch was hair-raising. He discovered that there were very weak compliance. Most of the clients involved were, in this Cayman Island branch were involved in tax evasion. So he started saying to his board back in Switzerland, look, you know, we've got a lot of problems here. We've got to sort this out. And instead of saying, we'll support you, the bank said, we don't want to know about this. It's not your job to sort it out. You just do your job and carry on. And he persisted, and he persisted, and they refused to take action. And eventually he said, enough's enough. I'm walking out on this one. If you aren't prepared to take action, we're sitting here on a lot of criminal accounts and criminal clients. I'm going to go public, which is what he did. And what happened next is really ugly, because this, not only did the bank start to attack him and his family, but he found that the Swiss government didn't support him. In fact, they started to harass him, and eventually they arrested him and put him into jail. And it was only because we started to kick up a fuss in the international press and embarrass the Swiss government that they backed down a bit. But he still hasn't got a job, and he's still being harassed. So it's a very ugly situation.
Yes, you know, it's pretty awful when there's no protection for whistleblowers. But ultimately, how big is this whole tax haven economy? Have you any idea?
Well, look, first of all, the tax haven economy is on a massive scale. It's so big that I would say now we've got to think about it as being a huge part of the global economy. Here's some estimates. There are no official statistics, and I would say one of the strangest things about the whole tax haven economy is that there are no official statistics. But here are some reasonably good figures. We know that at least half of world trade is passed on paper through tax havens in order for big companies to evade and avoid tax. Half of world trade goes on paper. We know that almost all cross-border investment goes through tax havens, again, in order to evade and avoid tax. The amount of private wealth held offshore in tax havens. Now take a deep breath, because you first of all, you have to understand what a trillion is here. A trillion is 1 million million, or 100 billion. So the sums we're talking about here are massive. The amount of wealth held offshore in tax havens, evading tax, is well over $20 trillion. Well, that's a global figure. We're talking massive sums. In terms of the United Kingdom, we think that the best estimate I've seen suggests that the United Kingdom loses at least £18 billion every year from tax evasion in through tax havens.
So well, I suppose
this affects us all because it means that our schools are being cut back, our education services are being cut back, our health services are being cut back, because the government won't tackle this issue.
Well, I suppose the obvious question is exactly that. Why? I mean, it seems to make sense to say, no, you can't do this anymore. Why don't the government say, no, you can't, and then they can collect all that wealth and skim it off in taxation?
Okay, this is a really huge question. And look, I've been studying this for 35 years, and as you said earlier on, I actually went offshore to work in the tax havens to find out how they operate. And ended up being economic advisor to the government of Jersey for 11 years. And what I discovered there was, you know, the reason why the UK government and other governments won't take action is because our elites use tax havens so extensively. The rich people in Britain, the powerful companies that use Britain, use tax havens right the way across the board. And, of course, they're not going to vote like turkeys. They're not going to vote for Christmas. They will not take action against tax havens. In fact, I've been an observer to the United Nations committee that's trying to tackle this for over a decade now, and I've watched how British government officials block attempts to tackle tax havens. I've seen exactly the same happening within the European Union. It is typically Britain working with places like Luxembourg and Austria that lead attempts to block progress to tackle tax havens. So we, the British public, are victims of a tax haven culture.
So
our rich elites and our powerful elites protect that very culture for their own reasons.
But how does this actually affect the rest of us? How does it affect ordinary people here in Britain?
Well, it affects us not only because we're losing a great deal of tax revenue, which means that our public services are being cut.
Have you any idea, John? You know, can you put a rough ballpark figure on, you know, how much we are losing?
Well, as I said earlier, the best estimate I've seen, and this comes from a company that specialises in this kind of research, is that we lose $18 billion a year to tax avoidance, tax evasion through tax havens. That's only part of the equation, because tax avoidance and tax evasion also happens here domestically in Britain. So the overall tax losses from tax evasion amount to $70 billion a year. And tax avoidance costs us about $25 billion a year. So the sums involved are absolutely massive. And the trouble is that the government really isn't serious about wanting to tackle this, because if it was serious, it would recruit more people into revenue and customs to start clamping down on this.
In fact, it's doing the opposite, isn't it?
It's done exactly the opposite, and that's the issue. And they say, well, we're adding staff. They're not adding staff. They are, in fact, cutting staff from revenue and customs. So the situation is likely to deteriorate. What does it mean for ordinary people? It means that ordinary people in Britain actually end up paying more tax, because, you know, whilst rich people are avoiding and evading taxes on a massive scale, the government responds to that by increasing VAT and increasing other types of taxes and cutting our tax allowances, because they're not prepared to tackle the tax evasion and tax avoidance. That means that all of us end up suffering in two ways. We end up paying more tax, but we also lose the public services. So it's really having a dramatic effect upon all of us individually.
Now, you seem to be almost implying that these tax havens have had quite a major role to play in the financial crisis.
Yeah, yes, they have played an extraordinary part in the financial crisis, and they continue to play an extraordinary part in the financial crisis. But what I think listeners need to understand, and this is very hard for ordinary people to understand, is that tax havens are not just about tax evasion. They're also places where banks and hedge funds and the what are called shadow banks operate, and they operate in places like Jersey and the Cayman Islands and Luxembourg because of the weak regulation they can achieve over there. In fact, in most cases there's no regulation in these places, so they can get away with doing whatever they want. And this means that, you know, if we talk about the what happened in 2007-2008 when the banks tripped up over collateralized debt obligations and the mortgage markets, one of the reasons why financial services authorities and other regulators hadn't realized what was going on was because a lot of these special financial instruments the collateralized debt obligations were actually prepared and issued offshore in Dublin, in Jersey, in Luxembourg and the Cayman Islands. And no one was actually regulating what was going on. In fact, very few people were aware of what was going on. So when it happened, it came as a surprise because they hadn't been assessing and understanding the risks that were building up in the banking sector. And that was because there's this kind of constant game of pass the parcel, you know, from one regulator to another. The banks were hiding these things offshore in the shadow banking system, and the regulators were saying, well, that's not actually our area of jurisdiction, so we can't regulate there. And they were assuming that the people in Dublin were doing that, which they weren't.
That sounds like a kind of crisis of regulation again. What, can you just explain, flesh out a little bit what you mean by a shadow banking system? That sounds almost spooky.
Well, it is pretty spooky, to be honest. look, the banks, over the course of the last few decades, have been using shadow banks. These are unregulated banks, typically offshore, for a lot of their activities. In fact, they account for a huge proportion of banking activities, and they like to do this offshore precisely because they're unregulated. And because they're unregulated, they are more profitable. So banks have been operating out of shadow banks. Technically, they're called structured investment vehicles, but because they can get away with, in an unregulated environment, a very profitable and therefore attractive environment for them, they do it in the tax havens precisely because they don't have to pay tax on the extraordinary profits they gain from working in this shadow banking system. So you have a combination of tax avoidance, lax regulation, it's all very attractive to the banks, so they use tax havens extensively for this, and the British regulators, by and large, paid no attention to it whatsoever.
Now, I'm trying to find a little bit of something positive in here. I mean, many of these tax havens are actually British, that is to say, the sort of the old colonies, this kind of thing. Have they actually benefited the British economy in any way? Because those tax havens are British tax, ex-British places.
Well, the story they spin, and Jersey is exactly what you say, it's a crown dependency, it's been closely associated with the Crown since 1066, when the Duke of Normandy invaded Britain. And Jersey's very close to the City of London. Its financial centre is a satellite of the City of London. And what they boast is, well, we're actually really good for Britain because we pass hundreds of billions of capital from other countries through to the City of London. And that appears to be really good for the UK economy until you start thinking about how that money is invested. This money, by and large, isn't invested in creating new jobs in Britain. By and large, it's invested in buying houses in London, expensive flats in London. It goes into the equity markets, but not to invest in new businesses, but to pump up the share prices of existing businesses. So I think that when you stand back and look at all these massive capital inflows into Britain, they're not nearly as useful for the local for the economy as we'd like them to be. In fact, I think there's clear evidence that they create property market bubbles in the southeast of England. They jack up equity prices on the markets here, and there's very little evidence that they actually have a positive outcome in terms of creating new jobs, new business, new research and development in the United Kingdom.
Okay, now what about, what can we do to actually take action against the tax havens, given that the politicians are sort of captured by the super rich and they aren't going to get their finger out?
Well, that's right. I think it's absolutely right to talk about politicians being captured in this country, and that applies across most of the parties. I think, first of all, it's helpful to recognise that there is a problem, and I think now people are recognising there's a problem, and it's a global problem. It affects most ordinary people across the world. I think it's important that we in Britain recognise that not only are most of us victims of this tax haven economy, but also that Britain is a major global problem because so many of the tax havens are so closely linked to Britain. You look across, you know, the tax havens of the world, and almost half of them have the Queen's head on their stamp, or fly some kind of Union flag, or are closely associated with the Commonwealth. So Britain is clearly a major player here. And as I said earlier, Britain is also blocking international attempts, both by the European Union and by the United Nations and by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, to close down on tax havens. So I think that what we all need to do is to start putting pressure upon our politicians. We need to write to our politicians, and we need to stand up to our politicians and say, what are you doing to tackle tax havens? We demand now that you take action, real action. None of it is difficult. It all involves simple measures to improve international cooperation between tax authorities and to improve the transparency of companies. None of it's rocket science. It can all be done very quickly. The British government has been blocking it for many years. We now must put pressure upon our politicians to take action.
Okay, given that, I mean, it's nice to know, to get a bit of a focus, but what specific measures would need to be taken to close down the tax haven economy?
Right, well, the first measure, and this would have a dramatic effect upon the tax haven economy, would be to adopt what's called automatic information exchange. Now, this is quite simple, really. If I, resident here in England, if I opened a bank account in a tax haven, in a branch in a tax haven, the branch in the tax haven would have to automatically inform the authorities in the tax haven that I, resident in England, have opened that account, and the authorities in the tax haven would automatically have to share that information under treaty arrangements with HM Revenue and Customs here in Britain. And just having that information that I've got that bank account would be enough to trigger their awareness that I've got that account, and if I start evading and not declaring the income on that account, then they would know. But anyway, there would be a constant flow of information about the income being paid on that account. That would be quite enough to close down a lot of personal tax evasion in this country and around the world. And that's the standard which the European Union already operates, and which we're trying to have extended to cover all countries and all tax havens around the world. So that's one measure. And Britain should now stop blocking attempts by the European Union to implement that effectively. And if they did that, we'd very quickly cut back on a lot of tax evasion. Another measure would be to cut back on tax evasion and avoidance by multinational companies, simply by requiring them to adopt an international financial reporting standard to disclose their accounts for every country and every jurisdiction where they operate around the world. And that would help us to identify and help tax authorities to identify where they're using tax havens to shift their profits out of the countries where they generate the profits into tax havens. Simple measures, nothing complicated about them, nothing very expensive about them, but this would do a great deal to improve international cooperation and tackle the tax havens.
Okay, John, the introduction to the second hour, I talked about a particular rather bizarre bit of news this week, that the Tetra Pak billionaire Ava Rousing, she kept much of her wealth offshore and as part of a cabin apartment which she'd bought on a cruise ship called The World. Now, this is a new one on me, the idea that you buy an apartment on a cruise ship and you can sort of hop in and hop out when you feel like it, but that is actually being used as a tax avoidance mechanism.
That's right. I mean, The World is a particularly bizarre thing, and I would encourage listeners to kind of Google The World and have a look at this extraordinary thing, which, from what I understand, is a really unpleasant place, because one of the sad things about very rich people is they're typically very selfish and self-absorbed. So you've got a huge collection of selfish and self-absorbed and rather greedy people on this ship, and from what I've heard, it's a really unpleasant atmosphere. In fact, that's been well covered in the Italian press. But I mean, in the case of Rousing, of course, that family, originally from Scandinavia, came to Britain, lived in London precisely because London is an offshore tax haven, and they have non-domiciled status here in Britain, which means they only pay tax on a very small proportion of their global income. As long as they keep their income outside England, they don't pay tax on it. And this is another part of tax haven Britain, which is why so many oligarchs from around the world move to London because they're largely living here, taking advantage of all the fantastic facilities that we provide here in London and in England, but they're not paying tax towards it. And this is a very unsatisfactory part of Britain's tax haven status.
Finally, John, we hear this week that the BBC is having to defend the fact that it is paying its employees as companies, and that, that many of those companies are actually offshore and abroad, as well as civil servants. This is a sort of breaking story, I think, brought out by XRO News, the news agency in London, over the last few weeks. Do you think there may be some movement on that? Because it seems that some of our taxpayers' money is going straight, rather than people paying PAYE, is going straight into companies in tax havens, and this is being used as a tax avoidance measure.
Well, that's absolutely correct, and I hope that the government will now take strong measures. This is unacceptable for a public broadcasting organisation to pay its senior staff in this way. It's unacceptable for anyone, frankly, to use tax havens for tax avoidance. I know they always say, look, what we're doing is perfectly legal, but I think what ordinary people have to understand is the tax codes in this country and in most countries are largely shaped to meet the interests of tax avoiders and the people who use tax havens. They spend a lot of money lobbying government to have these loopholes built into the tax codes. And they moan all the time about how complex tax arrangements are, but they love that complexity, because the more complexity that there is, the more opportunity there is for their lawyers to identify loopholes and exploit them. So I think that I hope the government is going to take very strong measures. The BBC should take strong measures now to close this down entirely. There's a simple word for this. They like to say it's tax avoidance. I'm afraid it's cheating. It's cheating all ordinary people in this country. It's time to close it down. But also, Tony, whilst we're talking about it, the issue has become very hot in America this week, because Vanity Fair, which is a hugely important magazine in America and around the world, has run a big story in this latest edition about how Mitt Romney, who's one of the candidates for the election opposing President Obama, has been using the Cayman Islands for his own affairs. And this story is pointing the spotlight on a presidential candidate in the United States, saying, well, what are you doing here? Why won't you disclose your tax affairs? Because is it right that a presidential candidate for the United States doesn't actually pay tax on his wealth in the United States? So this issue is becoming very, very hot, not only here in Britain, but also in the United States.
Okay, watch this space. John Christensen from the Tax Justice Network, thanks ever so much for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Pleasure. Thanks, Tony.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, the struggle against racism in South Africa, known as apartheid, was a hard-won fight. That was, and there's films been made about it, such as Have You Heard from Johannesburg? That film Tip is one from the leader, one of those leaders of the struggles, who's been in Bristol this week. Yes, to celebrate 100 years of the African National Congress, better known as the ANC. Bristol had a most distinguished visitor. Ronnie Casrils was one of the main organisers of the 1980s-focused anti-apartheid movement, which, along with African National Congress, overthrew the white minority racist government in South Africa with democratic elections in the 1990s. On the eve of Bristol's EDL march, Ronnie has some tips from and advice on today's struggles.
I'm Ronnie Casrils, a lifelong involvement in the liberation struggle in South Africa. Post the 1994 democratic election, I became a minister with various portfolios over 14 years. And since 2008, I've been involved as an author, writing books, giving lectures on the history of the struggle, but also on internationalism, issues around Palestine and so forth. I'm in Britain helping to promote this wonderful new book, London Recruits, edited by Ken Keeble. The book is about a remarkable group of youngsters in the 1967-72 period, London recruits, but from places as far afield as the United States, Ireland, all over Britain, France and Germany, Holland and places like that, who were part of the international anti-apartheid movement and its mobilization to isolate apartheid and put pressure on governments like the then British one that was in cahoots with apartheid. But we needed to do some clandestine things, and there were these many such tasks. It was a period post the Rivonia arrests where the underground in South Africa, following Mandela's arrest and imprisonment for life, and that of many others, that underground had been crushed. And those remnants who survived in Africa and in London, where I was, were seeking ways to get the message across to our people that the struggle wasn't over, as the regime claimed, and they were crying that from the rooftops. But there was hope that the underground organization would survive, that the struggle would survive. It was inspirational propaganda that we needed to get across. How to get this into the country? Leaflets and literature at the time. We needed brave and daring young people, people from the anti-apartheid movement who supported this just cause, who were brave enough to go into the country and engage in bringing that material under the noses of the authorities, who were not suspecting young white men and women, tourists from abroad, to enter. So the book is really about their exploits, why they did that and what motivated them, how they were recruited and prepared for such a mission, what they saw in South Africa, and the accomplishment very successfully of that mission and the impact that they made. They really did succeed in those 5 years, and we succeeded in getting that message across. And within 5 years or so, the underground network had been re-established. Some of these recruits went on to assist us right through to 1990, but this particular period, 1967 to 72, is what the book really focuses on.
Now, I suppose in the modern parlance, you would have been considered terrorists.
Well, I dare say that Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan referred to Nelson Mandela and Walter Sisulu and other luminaries of the struggle as terrorists, and later accepted them as freedom fighters. But, of course, it wasn't terrorism in any way. This was peaceful acts, clandestine, and these were in support of an absolute just cause against a criminal regime, in fact a terrorist regime, which was the apartheid regime.
Well, I imagine at the time it must have seemed like an unstoppable force, apartheid, and I think there's many people in Britain now that look at things like the elite in Britain, the city, is almost it's always been like that, it's an unstoppable force. Tell us about some of the successful tactics you adopted.
Well, let me first agree with you that in that period, this was an extremely gloomy period. People in South Africa, the masses in fact, were greatly intimidated, very depressed, downcast at the leadership having been captured. Many people were going to the gallows, being tortured to death in interrogation chambers and so on, and the police were extremely brutal. People abroad thought that there's no way that apartheid could ever be changed, that it was an immovable object, that they were too powerful and that we were too weak. But we focused on, if I can use Shelley's phrase, we are many, they are few, and the mobilization and unity of our people, the issue of losing fear. So psychological aspects of struggle were very important. Blows against the regime, just even propaganda blows or coups, we can say, when these leaflets appeared in the streets, they were scattered in various ways by various gadgets. This undermined the arrogance of the regime and its white support base, those who voted for it, greatly inspired the people.
It sounds like you're saying it was almost like a sort of battle for morale.
I would say that in any struggle, the psychological aspect of battle for morale is very, very important, without a doubt. And if you look at statements made in history, in struggles, there is this famous statement of the Vietnamese in the war against American aggression, and the Vietnamese won in the end and forced the Americans out, and they would say that they had the moral superiority over the Americans because theirs was a just cause of defending their country and ejecting this invasion force and this aggressor. And this is the message that we spread in South Africa as well, constantly. Ours was a just cause. It was against an immoral criminal regime. And the question of the moral ascendancy over their propaganda, their doctrine, etc., what they stood for, was very, very important. And it is to this day, whether it's in citadels of capitalist power and the clashes between people who are having to pay for cuts and the bankers and the big business and the corporates, really, the 1% of the world that we hear about more and more, having the power and with it all the wealth against people who are suffering. Okay, this is class aspect that I'm talking about. Yeah, the South African one was one of that as well, but of course the race aspect, which is why it was very possible for us to mobilize the way we did, because people right across class divides in the world were actually appalled at the racism of the apartheid state. And yes, we spread that point about the morality, the justice, and this is why from the communists and the trade unionists to the liberals and even some Tories in this country to the churches and religious groups, we managed to get the support of humanity.
What would you say to people who look at South Africa now and say, well, it's still corrupt, okay, there's not so much of a racist aspect to it, but actually you've replaced a corrupt white regime with now a corrupt multiracial regime?
You can't equate the two, of course, and you have allowed for that. But what we've done is we succeeded to overthrow a racist state. They did not allow black people their dignity, even the right to vote, and everything that goes with that in terms of human rights. It was a brutal regime. We had overthrown that, and we've established a democratic state and a system where we have peaceful elections, where we have very high level of vote, which has elected the ANC over and over again with big majority. That you can't take away from our achievement and what's been achieved in that sense. It's glorious, in fact, and it's given people their dignity. But of course there's a saying, and Krumah's saying, that first you win the political kingdom and then the economic. There are tremendous differences in South Africa as elsewhere in the world, in Britain or America, not just in Africa, of this divide in society. We're part of a capitalist world and we haven't broken away from it. And there's corruption in Britain and there's corruption in America and in France. And I mean, some of the escapades actually ours dwarf by comparison. It's not only black Africa where one finds corruption, but of course corruption is an absolute bane. It is something that prevents people and a state from running in terms of serving the people, which is what politics is about. It's something that we're determined to get rid of, and it is raised in South Africa. So there are things that happen there now which could never happen under apartheid. You get wives of ministers who get arrested and jailed. You get the commissioner of police arrested for corruption and is now serving 15 years. This is not a rare occurrence in South Africa. And like other countries, we're facing the same problem worldwide in terms of patronage, in terms of corruption, in terms of values, human rights, aspects which we fought for, which are undermined. But we're determined at this phase of the struggle to do everything possible to assert the rights of man, the rights of humanity, and to deepen and develop that democracy. So don't write us off.
For a lot of people now to get to grips with what's happened in South Africa, particularly for youngsters, could you suggest us one or two possibly documentaries, films to watch that might point people towards some interesting aspects of South African history?
I think one of the most outstanding documentaries which has been shown this last year is called Have You Heard from Johannesburg, which covers three instalments of the struggle and large segments on the international anti-apartheid struggle, the role of churches in South Africa and the churches internationally in support of the struggle and the people struggle themselves. There's Son of Africa about Nelson Mandela, and there's the Mandela books and books by Tutu, books by Walter Sisulu and others.
Well, that's a fascinating account by Ronnie Castrils of the anti-apartheid struggle. And I think he's absolutely right that things have definitely changed from the apartheid era. Things have improved in one sense. People have got their dignity, but the struggle still goes on against corruption, against violence and against injustice, as we well know.
Okay, and the films he was talking about there, we'll put on the website. That's www.thisweek.org.uk. But he was here to launch the book, and that's London Recruits is the name of the book, edited by local boy Ken Keeble, spelt K-E-A-B-L-E. Well, that's all the serious talk out of the way, because Friday night is music night, kicking off with 2 hours live in a moment with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Liberal Democrat Councillor for King's Weston, Simon Rayner. Also to John Christensen from the Tax Justice Network, and of course to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, Bristol's Railways, the true story of how First Great Western is profiteering off our need to get to work and also mismanaging Bristol's railways. Every BCFM show is available online. Just go to bcfm.org.uk, or even easier, thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show and our archives. A podcast of this show is online 10 minutes or so after broadcast. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Music this week is from 1953 and Tony Bennett. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Take my hand, I'm a stranger in paradise. All lost in a wonderland, a stranger in paradise.